This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Impact Theory Podcast, your source of empowering ideas and actionable techniques from the world's highest achievers. Join host Tom Bilyeu, serial entrepreneur and co-founder of the billion-dollar brand Quest Nutrition, on a journey to unlock your potential and realize your vision of success. Welcome to Impact Theory.
Everybody, welcome to Impact Theory. You are here, my friends, because you believe that human potential is nearly limitless, but you know that having potential is not the same as actually doing something with it. So our goal with this show and company is to introduce you to the people and ideas that will help you actually execute on your dreams. All right, today's guest is a former heart surgeon turned massive TV celebrity. When revolution broke out in Egypt in 2011, he and his friend launched a satirical YouTube show that brazenly mocked the powers that be, saying outrageous stuff that had never been seen on Egyptian TV before. The show touched on an explosive nerve and became an overnight sensation, getting 5 million views in just the first 3 months. Television offers started pouring in, and suddenly this heart surgeon found himself wildly famous and center stage during one of the most violent and tumultuous times in his country's recent history. His newly minted TV show, named simply The Show, was a bona fide cultural phenomenon, becoming the most watched show in Egyptian television history with 30 to 40 million viewers per episode. His social following ballooned up to over 15 million people, and he couldn't walk through a crowd without getting mobbed. But the government that formed in the wake of the revolution wasn't exactly a democracy. And as he said, can you imagine trying to have a political satire show in the time of Mussolini? Well, that was exactly what he was doing, and the pressure began to mount. In 2013, at about the same time that Time magazine named him one of the world's most influential pioneers, a warrant was issued for his arrest. His detractors began burning his photo and calling for his death. Yes, death. But armed with cojones the size of the pyramids of Giza, he continued to produce his show until it became so dangerous he couldn't get a station to carry it anymore, and he began to fear not just for his own safety, but for the safety of those around him. Eventually, things got so bad that with only 4 hours to pack and catch a flight, he had to flee the country. I have come across few stories that have inspired me more than this, so please help me in welcoming the subject of the documentary Tickling Giants, and the author of Revolution for Dummies, the man who proved a joke truly can be more powerful than a gun, the John Stewart of Egypt himself, Bassem Youssef.
I mean, what an intro. I should come here every day. And you've got like live audience. Like, I mean, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate that you got inspired by my story, but like, what are the other few stories that got you inspired more than mine? I feel jealous already.
You know what's interesting?
Just like we started on the wrong foot. It's horrible.
No, I like it. Let's go down the path. Who's inspired me more? That would be a tough order to answer, in seriousness. And so the way that you and I met was weird. So I don't know how it was for you, but I got invited to this random party with a really like bizarre invitation, which was meant to build like all this mystery, and it had my curiosity piqued. So I go and I show up. Now, in this party, we're not allowed to say who we are. So no one knows anybody's name, and you happen to be first. And yeah. So we go around, we guess what we think each person does. And I said, I think you're a famous like hair salon like stylist, which you were mortified by.
Because like I have horrible hair.
Which I'll disagree with that. But, and then you said who you were.
Yes.
And I freaked out because I had seen the trailer for Tickling Giants. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching that documentary going, this guy has a death wish. Like, it was scary from this country, from all the safety in the world, to watch somebody do such an aggressively satirical show in the time of Mussolini, as you said. Whoa. Give us a bit of the history. Like, normally I don't do the, like, what's the setup, but I think it's actually pretty important for people to understand what the time was like and what you were doing.
Well, I mean, it just, I, as you said, I was a heart surgeon. I was getting ready to go to Cleveland. And because I got a pediatric heart surgery fellowship there, and the revolution started, and I, like many doctors, I just went to the streets of Cairo to fix people's wounds because I had a very terrible aim. So instead of throwing stones, I just like fixed the wounds that they would inflict. And the revolution ended, Mubarak stepped down, and our dictator for 30 years. Which is known in the Middle East as the very short first term. And me and my friend, we were contemplating about creating a YouTube original content. Mm-hmm. And I was there as his guinea pig because I was his friend and I wouldn't charge him money. And and then when the revolution comes, kind of the opportunity presented itself. So I thought, all right, you know what? I'm just waiting for the visa papers to come. And I'm just going to do the show on YouTube from the laundry room of my home. And I did that. And I just like, you know, just like a trial, and then I'm gonna go, and maybe a couple of years later, some producer will discover that content on YouTube. And then, as you said, 5 million people in 3 months. And I know that now when you say 5 million, I mean, my cat gets 5 million views. But at that time, 2011, with no precedent of having original Arabic content on YouTube, that was unprecedented. Mm. And before I know it, every single network wanted to get me on their airwaves. And today I was signing the papers of a TV deal. The visa papers from Cleveland arrived. Mm. And here I was. I had the choice to do it. And because I come from a very traditional Middle Eastern family, my mom didn't mind at all that I would stay. Because, you know, all the mothers of the Middle East would keep their enemies close and their children closer. Sorry, their friends close and the children closer. And they wanted us. She didn't mind at all that I would stay. And I did. And for the first season, it was a very small pre-recorded show. And we did very well, but I wanted to go further. I wanted to do the Jon Stewart experience. I wanted to do the live audience. And this is yet another thing that was not being done in the Arabic media. I mean, nobody here is like, what, you're going to do live audience? Mm. And they will have to laugh on your show. Are you going to rent them? Just, no. Are you going to pay them? No, they have to laugh. Like, what if they didn't laugh? Like, well, we have to write better jokes.
Right.
And everybody was putting us down. It's like, oh my God, this is too expensive. You're not gonna get any money for that. No. Even if you got all the sponsors in the market, you're not gonna have like enough money to cover the budget. And I said, like, well, if you create good content, people will come.
Right.
And we did it, and we ended up having 30, 40 million people watching us. And at that time, that was the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist government.
Really fast, what percentage of the population is 40 million?
Like 40%.
And that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, there were like, I people would send me videos of their 2 years old watching, 3 years old watching, playing my songs. And it's just incredible. And
in the documentary Tickling Giants, they show some of the viewing parties.
Oh yeah.
And it was like,
it was Super Bowl every Friday.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like, yeah. So many people gathered around, indoors, outdoors, just like everywhere.
And there's actually one Friday there was clashes in the streets between the security forces and some of the protesters. And then when the show came, they stopped. They sat on the coffee shop next door.
Whoa.
Watched the show, then continued killing each other, which is like freaking amazing. And like, people were sending me these videos, and I was, wow. I was like, this is really surreal. And so everybody was watching it, and then the Islamists came, and of course, they didn't like what I have to say about them. And fast forward a year later, they were toppled by the military, and then now, and I was considered a national hero because I'm the one who stood against the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
And then I had my show, and I made one episode making fun of the military. That was enough to take me off the air. And the people who liked me yesterday hated my guts today. Right. Even members of my family disowned me, basically. And consider me as a traitor and a secret operative, of course. And then I found another channel, and then I started getting harassed even more, and my show got like the satellite signal got jammed a couple of times, and then the pressure on the channel stopped. Couldn't find any channel to carry the show. Everybody was scared, and then lawsuits starting like coming in, and they just like I was, and the lawsuits that like against me, they were like all like ridiculous, but it was just like a way of the regime to get you. And then there's a verdict against me at 12 noon, 5 o'clock. I was on a plane and I left the country. Wow. So that is the not so concise story.
Well, I mean, compared to the detail that you go in the book, which, by the way, is amazing. It does an amazing job of walking you through the story. And I want to pick apart some of the things because I know sort of where they go in the book. Like, when you have the choice to go to Cleveland, which you've been trying to get to for years, you wanted to get out of Egypt, I'm guessing, because you didn't like the political climate.
No, I didn't like the medical climate. At that time, I was not politically... I was not a politically active person. And this is what happens to you when you're under the same dictator for 30 years. You just give up. Right. You just like focus on your career. And I wanted to, because I wanted to have a better life, a better practice. And this is why I wanted to go.
So finally that comes. And now you've got the uprising, which at the time I'm sure feels truly like a revolution. You've maybe had different thoughts about what it takes to really be a revolution since then, but what was it, which seems like a time of wild instability, maybe the perfect time to leave. What made you decide to stay other than your mom, which I'm sure was real?
Well, I mean, when the revolution happened, there was like this like window between the papers arriving and the revolution. And this is where I started the YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. And what made me stay is like, well, TV, why not?
And was it at all like the sense that I could be a meaningful voice, or was it just, I know I'm going to be good at this, I'm going to love it?
I had no idea what I was doing. We were reverse engineering everything that we would see on American comedy shows, Colbert, Stewart, and we were trying to, how do they do that? I thought I would last one season. Mm. This was like a case of, if you're trying to build a Ferrari in a place where there was no highways and no factory to give you the primary elements of the car, right. Because it was like a totally a virgin scene. Nobody knew what was happening. Right. We hired people who were supposedly were the best at their field, and we fired them after 8 weeks because that was not the kind of job work that we wanted.
You like, burned like through three technical crews, right? Just trying to get them to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I mean, I got people who had absolutely no experience in media. The only thing that they had was passion. They had a passion to do this. And we just like, we learned together. Mm. Like I was like on top of the pyramid of that learning process. I was learning, they were learning, we were learning together. It was a trial and error. And we were scrambling. I mean, now if you do a show here, you have an industry. Right. You have a basics. You know, who's the showrunner you're going to get? You know, who are the producer you can, with the experience? At that, there was no experience. There was no showrunners. There was nothing, nobody we can go in and tell them, we are going to do a political satire show in front of a real life audience.
Right. What gave you the passion and the energy to, and I'll break that into two parts. At first, just to pull the show off, and then second, when people are actually threatening to kill you in a place where people actually get killed.
Well, at the beginning, when I did these YouTube videos, I really didn't think that this will go anywhere. I was just trying it.
Right.
I was just trying. It's like, you know what? This is the weekend. I have like hospital shifts. The whole week, I come on the weekend, I do that, and I shoot the video at my home, and that's it. I didn't really think. When it got serious, I was like, now I'm gonna get. And now I'm getting paid for this. Right. I better be good. And then you just get locked in, and you just have to up your game every single time. When things got ugly and it was more of a threatening situation, I have to be honest with you, I didn't know what made me going until I saw the movie Tickling Giants. Mm. Because I had no idea what was going on with this movie, because there was an agreement that with Sarah Taxler, who was the director of Tickling Trends and who was a senior producer of The Daily Show. She followed me for 4 years, and the agreement was that I will have no creative control. I'm just the subject of the movie.
Right.
Like any endangered species, a panda or a beluga whale. And I was there, and I watched the movie for the first time ever with the general audience in the Tribeca Film Festival last year in New York.
Wow.
I went in, didn't know what to expect. And I told Sarah as I went in, did you make me look good? Because this is what I'm leaving back for my family.
Right, yeah.
And I said, like, don't worry. I was like, I hope you like it. And I went in, and I saw those scenes of me with my team celebrating a birthday, one of the crew, and writing and doing all of stuff. And there are like riots outside and people threatening to kill me and the crew and whatever.
Literally during the birthday party.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was so weird.
Yeah, and it's just like, it was like, and I was like, oh, it's so funny. And I discovered like...
Which, by the way, is actually what he says
yeah.
in that moment in the documentary. Trying to have a birthday party over here. They, in the same shot, walk over to the window, look out. A mass of people out there threatening, turns away from the window, goes, so funny.
And now I'm looking at these scenes, and now it comes to me. I chose to detach myself from this kind of reality, because I was worried more about doing a bad show than having something bad happening to me.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Because we were just like, all right. We have to get these ratings. We have to get people. We have to write the best jokes. We have to be. It's like, it seems that I was worried about the backlash of Twitter not liking my show than being actually killed. And social media, baby. So I was actually so into the job that we have to deliver every single episode,
right?
More than anything else.
Would you have been into it like that though if it had been pure entertainment versus a political satire which had real cathartic meaning for the country?
I can't answer this question because a job is a job. I mean, I come from a medical background and you have to do your job. And when you do your job, you have to be perfect at it. You have to do the it's like you have a patient, you cut him open, you have to sew him back, and everything has to be perfect.
Reading your book, I know you're not oblivious to what the show meant to the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that weighs some amount, and then the other amount is you're also a legitimate entertainer who's very good at this and has a passion for just entertaining. And we'll get to what I think, from your actions anyway, answers this question, but what would you say is sort of the ratio between what was driving you, even if it's only now looking back, like what percentage was this is important and what percentage was I want to be, just like I was a great surgeon, I want to be a great entertainer?
No, I think it is not just being an entertainer, because when everything ended, I was offered to go back on the airwaves and just to do late night show.
Right.
Just go easy on the politics. Just do a simple game and fun. And
this was actually the government that reached
out. Yeah,
right?
They were like offering me like real offers. Like after I escaped, it was like, well, come back and we have
everything. Big money offers, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh my God, huge money. It's like money that I have never thought that I would even like have negotiated this amount of numbers, but this is like government money.
Right.
But when I say government money, I'm not talking about like shitty government money here. It's like talking about authoritarian money, like they have absolutely no limits. And I was offered many times by many entities to come back and just like, oh, you know, here's a game show. Oh, do it. Mm. And this is like an X million amount of money that you can do. And I said, I can't do this. It has to mean something.
When it comes to personal health, I am a huge proponent of using any technology that you can get your hands on to inform and empower you to make better decisions so you can reach your peak performance. And that's why I am pumped to introduce you to Lumen, an amazing new tool that can help you increase your energy levels, feel better, lose weight, maintain healthy weight, and much more. Lumen is the world's first handheld device that measures your metabolism through your breath. And after analyzing your breath, the app is going to give you tailored guidance and tips to help you overall improve your metabolic flexibility. Lumen is validated by peer-reviewed scientific research, and their recommendations are personalized to your measurements so you know you're doing what's best for your individual body. When you use Lumen, it's easier than ever to stay on top of your health game. So if you want to take the next step in improving your health, go to go.
lumen.me/impact, or just click the link below and you'll get $50 off your Lumen.
The competition business owners face today is massive compared to even just 20 years ago when I first got into entrepreneurship. So if you want a fighting chance against the competition, you need to be using the best technology and platforms in the world like Shopify. For whatever and wherever you want to sell, from launching to going international, Shopify is the global commerce platform that will help you grow at every stage of your business. With award-winning customer service, the internet's highest converting checkout page, and a suite of integrated AI tools, Shopify is your all-in-one platform to quickly and efficiently take your business to the next level. Shopify powers more than 10% of all U.S. e-commerce because businesses that want to grow quickly and efficiently choose Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/impact, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/impact now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/impact.
Ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet for anyone to see? Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, all being sold to the highest bidders online. That's why I recommend you take back control of your personal data with DeleteMe. Their experts search and eliminate your personal data from more than 40 data brokers and people search sites, and then they monitor those sites to keep removing your data if it's ever reposted. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe. Now, at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/impact. Be sure to use promo code IMPACT at checkout. The only way to get 20% off right now is to go to joindeleteme.com/impact and enter code IMPACT at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/impact.
So I think, like, maybe I didn't think about it at that time, but I think that this question was put to the test after the show was taken away from me, because I had more than one chance to go back and do the show as pure entertainment, and I didn't do it.
So from the outside, and you're very humble, which I really, really respect. But from the outside, one of the reasons that your story is so inspiring is it is ultimately a tale of courage, of action, even if internally all you felt was fear. That's fine. It's just the way that you actually behaved, the way that you presented yourself, is that sense of, I hope if faced in similar circumstances, I'd have the courage to make the same decisions. And there's an awesome quote, I don't remember who it's by, but it says, if ever faced with the choice of having to betray my country or betray my friend, I hope I have the courage to betray my country. Mm-hmm. And that, like, really resonated with me watching you from, again, this, I know this isn't how you see yourself, but watching it and saying, like, whoa, he's a voice for the country. He's a relief valve for them. And even if it's just cathartic laughter, or if it's actually seeing a path out of this and looking at the how crazy the ideology is, it really seems important. And it suddenly made me stop taking for granted what we're able to do in our media.
Yeah, well, I mean, after all the good things that you said about me, the nice things that you said, you will find a lot of people in Egypt that do not agree with you. They hate my guts.
Correct.
So the Islamists think that I am like the devil who single-handedly destroyed the only democratic experience that Egypt had.
So that's one of the things that's actually interesting about your approach, which was, when you really pissed people off was when they realized you weren't just making fun of one group, you were an equal opportunity offender, and so when the next regime came into power, you started making fun of them as well.
Yeah, but for them, oh, you didn't make fun of them enough. it was not the same joke. It's like, you will never win with these people, because for them, and you talked about ideology, when you are blinded by ideology, nothing else matters. Facts don't matter. Real news don't matter. Numbers, statistics don't matter. That's why when everybody's like, oh, it's fake news, or whatever, like, how can we change those people so they can see? It's like, they won't see. I mean, do they think they all, like, I mean, it, they people, a lot of my, and this is something I want to relate here, when I, what I've seen here in America. People have, like, always have this burning question, how can we make those people see the truth? Like, who told them that they don't see the truth? Mm. They see the truth. They choose not to accept it. They are blinded by that kind of ideology. They don't care. And even if you brought them, like, all of the sources, oh, these sources are flawed. These sources are biased. These sources have an agenda. So we will choose not to look at them. And this is why when people say, like, oh, how can, like, all of those political satirists, the Olivers, the Noahs, the Colberts, the Sam B., wonderful people. But do you think these people watch them? Do you think these people believe them? Do you think, like, the more jokes that you make about them, it's risen? We're preaching for the choir. And this is why when people say, like, how can we reach to the other side and is comedy and satire is a good tool? I said, like, no. And I'm pretty much blunt about this. Mm. No. They don't care. If you put, by numbers, what Obama did in the last 8 years was phenomenal compared to Bush. And they still believe that Obama brought the country down. It doesn't matter. Numbers, facts, news don't matter. In Egypt, when they give you, like, a piece of crazy news and say, like, where the hell did you get this from? Did you get it from CNN? Did you get it from BBC? Did you get it from France 24? Did you have anything? No. All of these Western media are conspiring against us. That's it. Alienated. It doesn't matter. Mm. So the whole this fantasy, this, like, perfect scenario of reaching to the other side, it doesn't matter. It will not happen.
Why do you think ideology trumps facts?
No, because it's an ideology. It's part of you. It is part of your thinking. It's the same thing if someone have a... I mean, look at what happened to Galileo, right? That was an ideology. That was science. And that was ideology. And the guy was punished because he came up with science that went against the ideology. All right, and doesn't matter if this was a military ideology, it's a conservative ideology, if it was a religious ideology, and sometimes some, like, you know, crazy liberal ideology kind of, like, don't want to listen to you. I mean, it's the disease is there on both sides. Because if you allow yourself to question that ideology with those facts, your whole ideology could actually come crumbling down. And this is why the most people who are very hard and very adamant about, like, not having anything questioned, the most conservative religious people, their first job is to stop questioning. Because if you start questioning this and that changes, then you're going to question another thing and then question another thing. And ideology is very rigid. It is not meant to be flexible. And it's just going to implode. So this ideology for them is everything for them. It's their identity. It's for their whole universe. And nobody wants his universe to implode.
Do you think at all about that in your own life? Do you worry that you have an ideology that you protect too much? Or do you actively try to keep it fresh?
No. I changed a lot. Things that I thought that I knew, I thought I believed in, I thought that, like, I really knew for a fact for over 40 years of my life. My God, the changes that I have done. I think that we just, like, we have to break free from so many things that's holding us back. And I'm kind of like I'm more accepting than ever.
And do you have a process for breaking free from some of those things? Like, what would you teach your kids about that?
I would teach them to be open. And I would teach them that the world is full of so many different things. And you should, like, keep an open mind. I'm now keeping an open mind. Only the things that I used to think about social norms, relationships, equalities for certain people, and it's just like all of that, it's changed dramatically for me. And I think we are, whatever time that we have in this life, we're here to learn and we're to accept. And as humans, we're too fragile.
What do you mean by that?
We're too unimportant. We are. I mean, we're too fragile, we're too vulnerable, too unimportant. We have this ego that just like, we cover all of this with ego. We cover all of this with, if you look to human history, all of these rituals and all of the ideas about death and what will happen, all of that comes from ego. We think that we are so important in such a vast universe that we have to create stories for us to believe.
And do you think that holds us back from living a fulfilled life?
Yeah, absolutely. Because like, who the hell are you to think that you are important? I mean, this whole planet can explode tomorrow. Even your own solar system wouldn't just like wait to stop, or they wouldn't matter. I mean, like, and now you have like the galaxies, and like we're so small. You know, who the hell are we to think that we matter for anything?
What do you hope your kids take from your story?
I think acceptance.
So what in your story do you think is about acceptance?
Accepting the fact that I am continuously learning and continuously changing my mind and continuously flexible. I mean, even for the smallest things that I do on a daily basis. I live here now in Los Angeles, and I live my life as a student. Mm. At the age of 43, I'm taking acting classes, improv classes, writing classes, and I'm always the oldest guy in the class. I'm double the age of anybody in the class. Mm. And I'm not shy. It's like, and I'm doing stuff that I never thought, that me, the doctor, the surgeon, that I would be on that path for the rest of my life. And I've reinvented myself 3-4 times in the last 6 years. Wow. And which is, I think it's a blessing. And I think your story is like that too. You invented yourself, invented your career like 3-4 times also over a period of time. And so I think we are born into a society that just want to put you into molds. And it's a struggle to continuously break those molds, which is very interesting but very scary.
Talk to me about that. So reinvention is amazing, and I love that that's your outlook. You went from being a surgeon to being
a YouTube guy,
absurdly famous.
No, first of all, a YouTube guy, and then like a TV guy, then a bigger TV guy, then an outcast. Then I come here now, and I'm trying to build a career in a country where I have a English as a second language, trying to get through audience who's not my primary audience, and trying to do something that I was never had formal training in doing.
Is it weird though, going from, so fame is like lightning in a bottle, and you had massive fame. You don't seem hung up on it got taken away from you, but it has to be at a minimum intriguing, the difference between if I were in Egypt, that I can't walk down the street without people mobbing me, taking photos, kissing my cheeks, and now I'm here in Los Angeles and most people don't know who you are.
Yeah. It is very nice and very humbling.
You prefer that, or it's just useful?
No, of course you prefer to be famous and successful and everything. But as you said, this takes me back to a conversation that I had with Jon Stewart, and I told him like I don't know what to do after everything was like taken away, and he said, "Don't get hung on that, because what you have done is already being carved in history. You have to go move forward, and it doesn't have to be the same thing."
What do you want the fame in the U.S. to be for?
I want to be a different voice. I represent a sub type of a population, which is usually portrayed in a very negative way, Middle Easterners. And I'm not even born here. So there's a lot of people from the Middle East who have been born here.
Right.
So they don't have the accent. They are like pretty much, you know, can pass for at least vocally for an American. I am literally fresh off the boat, right. And I'm trying to make it here, which is, I think, very unique. And maybe to give a different voice, a different perspective of what's happening in the world and what's happening to people like me.
Are you proud of what you did in in Egypt?
I am proud that we have created something that was never there. Most of anything. I mean, I'm not going to talk to you about like the patriotism or the political activism, whatever. Like technically, as like what we have done to entertainment has changed the landscape of entertainment. Before we came in, the only shows were there were like boring daily, nightly shows, talk shows that like the whole Egyptian television and most of Arab television was locked in 1980s. It's boring, it's horrible, it's redundant. What we did that we brought in high quality entertainment. We made everybody like follow it. And after, even after we left, the landscape of the media there has changed.
Talk to me a little bit about your mom, I think, and your decision to become a surgeon.
Yeah, well, in the Middle East, you're only allowed to be a surgeon or an engineer. That's it. Anything else doesn't count. Like, the only thing that gives pride to most families, not all families, but like many families, is like being a doctor, a dentist, an engineer. And I didn't like math, so I went to medicine.
Fair enough. And all that same work ethic that you had to really do a great show, did you look at being a surgeon the same?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a nerd. You have to have high marks. You have to be in and you have to just like know your stuff. As a matter of fact, so I brought medicine into the show. The long hours, the brutal work style, it was all medicine. I was like one of the first people to come in the morning and the last person to leave at night.
Did your parents teach you that work ethic, or was that something that you picked up in medicine?
I was not allowed to be anything but one of the top of the class, even at school. So it just, or else they're going to be very disappointed. So nobody wants to disappoint their parents, so I just like carried that nerdy lifestyle all through my life.
How did you deal with that as the show's getting bigger and obviously it starts to become an issue, right, for your family? How did you deal with that tension?
Well, my dad was pretty cool. As long as he had free tickets to the show, he didn't care for him and his family, if he had friends, so he can like brag about it. My mom was a different case. My mom, what her relation with me is defined by one thing, that she is constantly worried about me. Mm. That's it. She's worried about me.
Story, yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're successful, I'm worried that you're not married. It doesn't matter if you marry, I'm worried that you don't have kids. It doesn't matter anything. It just constant worry the whole time. And when I did my show, I never actually saw her 100% elated or happy because of the show just doing well. It's like, oh, but I'm worried about you. I'm worried of that, what will happen to you. Always, because I was there just like heading butts with the authority all the time. And that was like a constant issue for her. There's three stages of the show. First, right after the revolution, when the military took over for an interim period. Then the second was the Islamists took over, and the third when the military took it back. And with the Islamists, she was happy but worried. With the military part, she was furious because the military is untouchable. You can't make fun of the military. The military, for many Egyptians, is even more sacred and more holy than religion itself. And it's like, oh, how can you make fun of it? And it really caused tension between us. It defined the relationship all through the time that I was having my show on the air.
What do you think are the similarities between what's happened in Egypt and what's going on in the political climate here in the U.S.?
I can't say similarity, but there are certain scenes that, especially when you see the Trump supporters, the whole idea of the right-wing conservative movement, the narrative is pretty much similar to what I've seen in the right-wing conservative movement in Egypt, which is the military and the Islamic movement the whole idea of about creating an enemy, creating a distraction, creating fear, making everybody afraid. And because they're afraid, I can push my agenda. And because of that, it's fine to take away somebody's else's liberties or somebody's right. And it's the whole thing. It's the oldest trick in the book. Create an enemy, make everybody afraid, and just like push your agenda. The whole idea about fear of from the other. Here you create the enemy of the Mexicans, the Muslims, the refugees. There it is everybody else.
And why is fear so powerful? This was something that really distressed me reading Revolution for Dummies, was the idea of just how effective it was to use fear and how easy it was to get people to behave essentially and fall in line behind a radical government, but they were using fear to keep people in line.
Security comes in the priority, number one priority of people's need even before food. If you play with that concept of people's minds, they're mushy in your hands. You can do whatever you want. Mm. And because if you have no security, the whole other thing, so you can have famine, you cannot have food, but you can have food, but no security, so it's gonna be gone. So fear is the number one motivation. It is, it's a magic weapon. Look at all the wars, all the tensions that happened in human history. It is based on, but like, those people are coming to kill us, we have to kill them first.
Is there anything that you've ever seen that can be used to combat that? Like, what do you think, if there is one, is sort of the secret weapon to hold that at bay?
Well, I will say satire is a great weapon, because like, if you're laughing, you're not afraid anymore. But you have to do that in a climate that allows that. Mm. So when under the Islamists were not powerful enough to stop my show. So I could make fun of that, and that kind of holy image of like the very pious religious man was just like being ridiculed. The military, I continued doing that for a while, and I was starting to actually like take punches against them, and they were just like too fast to take me off the air. And this is why in any dictatorship, you will never find satire. There's comedy and satire, but it is directed towards the people. Right. Like, oh, let's make fun of ourselves, about our social behaviors. Let's make fun of the traffic, about marriage, about divorce, about the bureaucracy, about how bad we are as human beings, but never up there.
Yeah, that's watching the documentary, reading the book, and really looking at sort of the human nature elements that they spoke to was deeply distressing. Is there anything in everything that you went through about human nature? Like, what was the thing about human nature that scared you the most? What was the thing about human nature that you found the most beautiful and inspiring?
What scared me the most is like how people can just like flip overnight. And I had family members. I had people that went with me to school, people that I've known for 20, 25 years. And who because I said something that would threaten their ideology, believed the most hideous gossip about me. I mean, there were people who really believed that I was a secret operative, that I have a secret agenda, that I'm being paid by the American government to bring down the country. It is ridiculous.
And what was the most beautiful thing that you saw in all of this?
The resilience of some people. There are people back in Egypt, amazing political activists who were jailed, had their loved one jailed, tortured, and they still, I mean, we sit here and talk about how brave and how courageous I am. That means that is dwarfed by those people back there who are stuck, who couldn't get out, who have their family in jail because of something they said, or because of a Facebook post, or because of a political position. And this is, it is not beautiful, it is admirable, it is impressive, it is worthy of all of the wonderful compliments that you have been pouring on me the whole time here, and much more. They are the real heroes. I was just like a guy who was telling jokes, and I had to leave because of that. But these are the people who are suffering.
What made you, when the warrant for your arrest came out, and the arrest warrant essentially came out because you wore the big hat to mock the then president, and when you turned yourself in, and when you turned yourself in, you wore that hat again, what gave you the guts to do that?
Well, I decided to take that hat and go to the to my interrogation, and people's like, "Are you crazy?" It's like, "Oh, you know, you just like this is what you get when you mess with a joker. You get made fun of." And it was just like, there's two ways out of this. Either I'm going to get out, I'm going to be arrested. And this, me doing the hat will do nothing but just make them feel like look worse. Mm. So it's my mission to make them look worse. And it was just like my way to tell them, like, F you, basically.
And it worked.
It worked.
All right, so because sadly we're running out of time, let's talk about your mission to, do you want to create a company around launching vegan foods? Like, what's the driving force?
I am more of like creating a movement. I'm a big believer that like whatever what we have thought that is healthy food is actually making us sick. I'm not going around people like, you have to be vegan, you have to be vegan. I don't do that. Of course, there's like amazing benefits of this about like saving the planet and like being good to other creatures. But I am really concerned about changing people's behavior, because I don't think that we are made to even if you decide that you're not going to be vegan. But like, I don't think that we should consume that amount of dairy and meat that much. This is like our consumption has increased dramatically in the past 100 years, and then we're just like, oh, where did this all like chronic diseases are coming from? This spike, this increase of the chronic disease have to come from somewhere. And I just want to like educate people in Arabic and in English about what their food choices. And I'm not the first one to do this. Mm. There are like the amazing people who've done like Forks Over Knives, Cowspiracy, What the Health. Food Inc., all of these people, this is something that has already been done before, but I want to make it more mainstream.
And are you pushing a show around this, or do you actually want to create a food company?
I want to start first with a digital show in Arabic and in English, so I can speak. So like the two sides of the world that they wouldn't think they have anything in common, they're, you guys are eating the same thing and you're dying with the same shit. So, and then I want to create like kind of a brand in order to guide people how to deal with their illness and their diseases. And hopefully when people see people in their households getting better and getting rid of things like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, we think, oh my God, I have to. I mean, this is like diseases that actually created because of the food choices. But you go to the doctor and they give you steroids. Mm. I don't understand.
Are you following the whole functional medicine movement, for lack of a better word?
No.
It's interesting. I'd be really curious with your history as a surgeon to see what you think about it. Basically, they're saying very much the same things. Like, it's not genetics are not causing this problem. This is a problem of diet, lifestyle in general.
Oh, yeah.
And until we address that, like if you have Crohn's disease or something like that and you go and you're taking steroids, you're masking the symptom, not the cause, and actually getting to root cause, looking at the human body as a super organism in essence.
Yeah, I mean the whole idea about like blaming genetics on it, it's just like the easy way just like to kind of like put the guilt on something else. You see, for example, first generation Japanese or Chinese, right? They are pretty much loyal to the kind of food that they are eating. So they stay slim.
Right.
Now look at the second, third generation, they're getting fatter. They're getting sicker. They're having more propensity to get like diabetes or any of the other chronic disease. So suddenly genetics change because you came here? Mm. It's because what you put in your mouth. So I'm a big believer of that. And I'm sure it's like a lot of backlash, a back of pushover. But like at the end of the day, you have the big pharma and the food industry. They spend so much money lobbying in the Congress in order to make pizza classified as vegetables or French fries as vegetables. And this is the stuff that you're giving to your kids. And this is why, like, and this is like a very, I'm sure that everybody would like a circle of people who have kids. Now they have the same thing. It's like, oh, my daughter or my son is 7 years old and he's already allergic to half of the things in our kitchen, right? Mm. Where did these food allergies come from? You have altered their immune system by what you're giving them as food, thinking it's healthy.
Agreed. All right. Where can these guys find you online?
All right. Twitter is @BYusuf, Instagram, Basim Yusuf, and... I'm launching my website soon that will get, and of course, Bassem Youssef has Facebook, and I'm doing a website soon that will do everything. It's called BassemYoussef.net, so.
All right, my final question.
Yes.
What's the impact that you want to have on the world?
The impact that I want to have of the world, that I would like to have people laughing at their problems instead of killing themselves because of it.
It's a pretty damn good answer.
Yes.
Bassem, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Thank you so much.
What a pleasure. Guys, you're going to love digging deep into his world. It is really astonishing. Absolutely go watch the documentary, Tickling Giants. Read the book, Revolution
99 cents on iTunes right now, documentary. It's a sale, 99 cents. It's number 4 now on iTunes. Go get it.
It is absolutely fantastic. And to have gone through what he's gone through and to now get a chance to watch him and see what he does now that he's here in the US, to see how he reinvents himself, which is absolutely astonishing. And just getting to go on that journey with him and ask yourself the questions along the way, where would you tap out? And I do fear that I would have tapped out a long time before he did, which is why, while I fully understand that there's always a hero that's done even more, it was an astonishing story, and it was very inspiring to me to see somebody stand by their guns. If he'd been just about the entertainment, he would have taken the money, and it sounds like he was offered a lot of money. But he didn't, and he's here now. He's a student again, starting from scratch, going from insanely famous to back at the ground floor without a loss of step, without losing that sparkle in his eye, without the amazing or loss of amazing ideas that he's had all throughout his career and the willingness to pursue them and chase them forward. So I am very eager to see what he does from this point forward. So go and do as I have done, my friends, and subscribe to all his social feeds. Keep an eye on this man's absolutely fascinating.
I should come here every day. This is amazing.
This is like
an ego boost. Like, amazing, man.
All right, guys, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe. And until next time, my friends, be legendary. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much for watching. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe. And for exclusive content, be sure to sign up for our newsletter. All of that stuff helps us get even more amazing guests on the show and helps us continue to build this community, which at the end of the day is all we care about. So thank you guys so much for being a part of the Impact Theory community.